From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Have you recently fooled around with that face app? You know, the app that ages you or makes you younger? It's all fun and games until someone at the dinner party says, "This is all about Russian hackers getting their facial recognition tools in order to perpetrate untold meddling into our worlds." You wonder how true it is and how easily your deepest and least penetrable privacy is compromised. After all, you thought it was supposed to be anonymous. Well, here to help us decipher all of this, how our privacy is affected by the gathering of big data, is Sophie Bushwick. She's a writer for Scientific American. She has an article in this month's issue titled "Anonymous Data Won't Protect Your Identity." Sophie Bushwick, great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, we were just, you didn't hear our introduction, but we were just throwing out a few ideas about the gathering of big data. And I was talking about the face app, the facial aging or I guess, making you younger app that people are having so much fun with.
Right.
And I was wondering if that is part of, you know, can that be part of a big data set that is supposedly anonymized?
It could be. If it's not collecting your name and your phone number, for example, then you could see that as being anonymized, but because it is your face there, you'd imagine that if someone's looking at the set and they say, "Hey, I recognize that person," you could be re-identified from that set. But a lot of the times when researchers talk about an anonymized data set, they mean something like, for example, they might have some medical records of people who came into a hospital with cardiac issues and then went on to have a heart attack. So you could see a researcher wanting that data because they could use it to develop a model that would help them predict when a person was going to have a heart attack. But because you don't necessarily want to share someone's personal medical information, the people who own that data, so what they could do is they could take away the names associated with it, take away the social security number, and instead assign each person say a random string of numbers. So this is patient 123, this is patient 124, and so on. The problem is that a lot of times these data sets include just so many pieces of information that it's really easy for someone to look at it and to extrapolate from the information on hand who this person is, even if it's anonymized.
So your article in Scientific American that's just come out this month is about this. It's about how we might think that our data is being anonymized. And by the way, that was a new word for me, anonymized. I guess it's a tech term. Is that right?
That's right.
So we might think that, but really, if you get a set of anonymized data, even, well, you use the example of like 15 pieces of anonymized data, the way that AI works, basically, is they can suss it out and figure out who it is.
Right. So the researchers who did this study, they found that if there's 15 pieces of information about each person in this data set, so these pieces of information might include your gender, your birthday, maybe your marital status, the number of kids you have, could even include how many cars you own. If there's 15 little tidbits like that, then there's a 99.98% chance that you could be re-identified, even if your name wasn't associated with that list. And 15 might sound like a lot of pieces of information, but there have been cases where companies collect, you know, hundreds of data points about each member of a data set. And even if there are fewer pieces, the researchers actually have this kind of cool and terrifying tool online. What you do is you enter your birthday, your gender, and your zip code, and it tells you the odds that you could be re-identified just from those three pieces of information. And the average person has about an 83% chance of being re-identified if just from those three data points alone.
Yeah, Sophie, in your piece, you write that in 2017, a marketing analytics company got in some trouble for accidentally publishing an anonymized data set, and they had 240 attributes for each of the 123 million American households. That's an astounding number. And if you only need a dozen or so to get there, it's pretty scary, isn't it?
It is. It's really, I think one of the scariest parts of it is how little control we personally have over our information being out there. So if a company is a little bit clumsy with their protections and this data is leaked, there's no way to call that back and to retain control over our own information. It gives you this feeling of powerlessness.
Yeah. And back to Lynn's original question about, you know, these cute little things that they do. You know, you can age, or you can put a mustache or a beard on your sister, or, you know, whatever. It kind of lulls, you know, I don't believe that is going to allow people to steal your data, but I do believe it's going to lull people into the cuteness and the fun of technology, you know, the puppy, rainbow, and unicorn argument that people, oh, you know, this can't be bad, you know, this is okay.
Right.
I think that's dangerous.
Well, I think there's a lot of apps that are like that, that you say, oh, this is a cute thing I want to try, and you end up giving them more information than you realize. Then you think they're just using that information to, right, put a little puppy on your picture or animate your face or make you look old, and what they're really doing is maybe gathering faces to train a facial recognition app. But the problem is that, you know, you could say, I'm going to be a very cautious consumer. I'm not going to download apps like that. I'm not going to give them access to my data. And you might pat yourself on the back. But if you really wanted to stop putting data out there, you'd also have to give up your credit card, your cell phone, any internet access, and probably any hospital visits as well. I mean, in order to function in our society, you have to do things that produce data, and you have very little control over how that data is used.
So, Sophie, I just have to ask you to go back to this digital tool that you say you can enter your birthday, mm-hmm. your gender, and your zip code. You talk about it in the article, and there's a link in the article to this tool, but it mm-hmm. seems as though you can only access the tool sort of, maybe it's not out on the open market yet, And it sounds like a way to to gather your data
the
tool.
Yeah, I think that the researchers put a note on their website saying, hey, we just so you know, we will delete everything you enter here. But by the time I used it, I was so paranoid, I used a fake birthday for my test.
Oh.
And the other cool thing about that tool, though, is so you start out by just putting your birthday, gender, and zip code. And when I did it, I happened to live in a zip code with a lot of people. So my chance of being re-identified was pretty low. It was only about 34%. And then I scrolled down a little bit, and there's another option where you can say, well, what would happen if I added one more data point about myself to this thing? And so I said, I clicked a button and I added information about my marital status, and my odds of being re-identified jumped from 34% to 97%.
Wow. Wow.
Just from one additional piece. Yeah.
So this is really good information, I would think, for all of us to know, to just heighten our awareness about what information we provide. However, that said, there's a lot we can't do online without providing these bits of information, no matter how benign we think they are.
Yes, that's true. And I think there's a different study did a survey and found something like, I think 72% of U.S. citizens do worry about sharing personal information online. But in many cases, you're not really given a choice.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Sophie Bushwick. She writes for Scientific American. We did a show a while back on Uber. Let's say you're in New York City and you're standing at the corner of an intersection and you're using Uber for the very first time, and you get Uber to come to you and they send you a note and they say, would you like to enable geolocation so that the Uber driver can go exactly, you know, within 6 meters of where you're standing? And you say, yeah, mm-hmm. sure.
And what we found out in that show was that once Uber gets your permission to engage geolocation on your phone, they always keep it on. They always know where you are, always. So I don't know anybody that reads the fine print of the terms and conditions that they scroll down to the bottom of the screen and then agree to. We really don't know what permissions we're giving to these companies. So when you talk about the organizations that are responsible for keeping the data, we really don't know what permissions we're giving them, do we?
No, we don't. I think that opaque privacy policies are one of the worst sins of Silicon Valley. If you're faced with hundreds of pages of a document, I can't think of anyone who goes through the trouble of reading it, except maybe a journalist who wants to do a story about how terrible privacy policies are. And so, yes, many of us are unaware of what we're giving away. I think that, you know, if I could wave a magic wand and put rules in place, I would say that these privacy policies really need a little bullet-pointed list right up at the top that tell you in plain English what you're giving away by agreeing to use a product. But I think that barring some sort of legislation, that's not necessarily going to happen. One thing the researchers who did this most recent study did suggest is that there is a need for laws to protect consumer data because we don't really have control over what companies are doing with it. So if you look at, for example, in Europe, they've got the GDPR. And that those regulations actually distinguish between multiple types of data. They say, okay, so there's your personal data with your personal information attached, and you have the right to ask for that to be deleted. And then there's what's called pseudonymous data, which means your name isn't on it, but you could probably still be re-identified from it. So, and then the last type is anonymous data. So that's data that they've not only taken your name off it, but they've also messed with the numbers to make it harder to re-identify any one person. And there's a few different techniques they can use to do that. So one of the suggestions in the paper is that these companies, if they want to call their data anonymous, they need to do more to prevent people in this data set from being re-identified.
Well, let's talk about pseudonymous data. About a year ago, I was interviewing a panel. I was moderating a panel at a technology conference. And one of the companies there that I interviewed, the name of the company is Anonymy Labs, and they're located in Salt Lake City, and they have offices around the country. Basically, what they do is they allow you to get a pseudo, is what they call it, S-U-D-O, which allows you to shop, sell, socialize, do everything that you do on the internet without anybody knowing your name, who you are, or any information. And their desire is to build these tools that'll shift the balance of power from public and private data brokers and advertisers and organizations and everyone else back to the user. So I jump on Amazon, and Amazon doesn't know it's John Wells and my birthday and all that sort of stuff. It's too late. They already know that. But let's say I was jumping on there for the first time with a pseudo. All that data would be firewalled from the organization. Are you familiar with those types of companies?
There's absolutely a growing collection of tools for people who worry about just how much data they're giving away. So you find stuff like there's a search engine called DuckDuckGo, which doesn't save any of your data about what you've been searching. It doesn't, you can look up how to be anonymous on there, and it won't make a note that, oh, this is Sophie has been looking about how to stay anonymous. This is something that is an interest for her. Maybe we can serve her ads about it. So DuckDuckGo doesn't do that. And there's also web browsers that sell themselves as being, look, we're not going to collect all this data about you. But I think the issue is we don't necessarily trust companies with our data, but there are good things that can be done. So you've got to keep this sort of balance between you deserve to protect your own privacy, but also you can do really interesting things with some of this. So, I mean, I've mentioned the medical data example before, but that kind of information is very valuable to researchers who want to be able to, say what are the danger signs that somebody might be about to come down with a disease that maybe we could prevent. And they can learn about this by using algorithms to study these big masses of data. So I think that the solution to this problem isn't to say no gathering data at all. I think it's to force companies to be more responsible about the data that they do collect.
Yeah, back in the day of the bird flu, Google provided information to the CDC on the number of and the types of browser requests that were made about the symptoms of the bird flu. And they were able to, through some math that they did, some algorithms, they were able to ascertain where the stuff was breaking out next and where it was currently starting to fester and that sort of thing. But I don't think that they really needed to know the age of or the name of the person. So even if you had some sort of pseudo or had an ability to be able to block that information, the researchers, they may not know your age, but they could still get this data, couldn't they?
I guess it depends what they're hoping to learn from the data. And I guess I think at the moment the way it works is a company, say a data broker, they'll either buy or they'll collect all this information about people, and then they'll bundle it into a data set, and they'll take away the names, which is, they'll sometimes run a few different techniques on this data set. They might use a technique called sampling, where they don't include all of the entries on it. They might include only 10% of the people that they've collected information about, and then they sell this bundle to other organizations. So they might give access to researchers who want to make medical decisions. They might give access to marketers who want to better target people with ads and want to learn about human behavior. So there's all these different things they can do with it, and it's a resource for them. It's something that they can sell. And I think the issue specifically being addressed in this paper is that these data sets for sale are not as anonymous as the people selling them think they are, or as the people buying them think they are, or as we consumers would want them to be. And they're hoping that there's other techniques that these companies should apply, and there's more testing that they should do to ensure that you can't buy a set of medical data and say, oh, hey, this is my boss whose personal information I just found.
When we start talking about the downsides of big gathering data and our infringement on our privacy, it gives you pause, and it makes me have sort of a lack of creativity around looking at the big picture and the good that big data is doing. You know, you've talked about medical advancement and being able to pinpoint, like John's example of the bird flu. Was it the bird flu?
Yes.
Yeah, the bird flu. but what are the other upsides that you have found in your research that are really compelling?
Well, one thing that so this is another medical example, but just the week after I was writing about anonymous data, I was, Scientific American covered a study that wanted to predict kidney failure, which is one of the most common causes of death in hospitals. It happens very quickly with very little warning, and even when it doesn't kill a person, it can cause permanent damage that requires a lifetime of dialysis afterward. And by looking at a big set of medical data, the researchers were able to develop an algorithm that could predict this kidney failure 48 hours in advance, which is enough time for doctors to apply treatments that could mitigate the damage or prevent it from happening at all. And that's the kind of finding that medical researchers are hoping to get from this data. So if we go outside the field of medicine, you've got behavioral information. You can learn a lot about human behavior, what people are interested in. If you're a marketer, this is valuable, but I think that we as the public don't necessarily care about making marketers' lives that much easier. But you can also learn about, so a sociologist could learn about human nature. If you study demographics, you can look at the changes in population over time, and you can learn something about the changing makeup of an area. So this would be of interest for historians, sociologists, that kind of thing. There's a ton of applications for for big data just because we're finally developing the computing process, the computing power and the algorithms that are able to extract, you know, really interesting information about it.
Yeah. That kidney failure example is very, very compelling. And yes, as you say, the data sets that are sold to marketers, I don't know anyone who loves, once they've Googled, you know, hotels in Paris, who enjoys having those pop-ups come back, even after you've already booked your hotel, and then they haven't gotten that figured out, so they keep presenting more hotel ideas for you. And you're like, leave me alone, mm-hmm. I've got my hotel.
Yes, you might buy a pair of shoes online, and then you continue to get shoe ads for months afterward, and you want to say, I already bought it. No, yeah. It's no good.
And it really detracts from, say, the shopping experience. You know, I don't want any more shoes. In fact, I'm not going to buy online again, which is what we sort of say. And then, you know, whether we follow through with it is another story.
Sophie, I got to tell you, she loves shoes. Lena's always looking at pictures of shoes.
I mean, I think the issue is that this negative privacy invading stuff comes along with huge conveniences, like, yeah, the ability for me to do my shoe shopping online, that's a convenience. And a lot of us, you know, you might read something about Amazon collecting information and say, oh, that's awful, I'm not going to do business with Amazon anymore. And then the next week you're back on the site because the convenience that it offers is enough to overcome some of your repugnance about maybe their privacy practices.
And so we're talking about anonymizing data and all of that, but as you say, there are a lot of positives to big data and the mining of big data, and we've already learned a number of things, and we've learned unintended, you know, through just searching in different ways and thinking about samples of data in different ways and graphically looking at it and looking at it from all sorts of different angles. It really has helped us, hasn't it?
Yes, I think that there's major breakthroughs to be had from data. I mean, if you look at something like, say, recycling practices, you know, if you were to buy an anonymous data set showing what sort of search terms people used when they looked up recycling, you might say, oh, look, a lot of people in this area have been looking for how to recycle glass bottles near me, and there's not a glass bottle recycling collection point there. So you might say, oh, we might be able to change our policy. This might be a place that it's good to put that. That's just, you know, one example of the kind of information you can get from browsing data. But the other thing is that, so I talked about Google, when you browse, does save your browsing history, and whereas a search engine like DuckDuckGo does not. But partially as a result of Google having all that data, they're very good at turning up the search result you're looking for. With DuckDuckGo, you might have to scroll down a little bit more before you find what you're looking for because they don't use data as intensively as Google does.
And there's some really good work that's being done in pattern recognition. And I know of a company that's developed a whole chipset for just driving pattern recognition with large data sets. So I'm looking forward to what, you know, that sort of stuff comes up with. But it's pretty interesting.
Yes, I think that especially as we're moving into an era where self-driving vehicles are becoming more of a possibility, being able to predict how those are going to react with human drivers on the road, I think, is going to be quite important, and I think that data definitely can help with that.
Our guest is Sophie Bushwick. She's a writer for Scientific American. And Sophie, I just have to say, clicking on your name on the website of Scientific American exposes all of these varied topics that you write about, from forest fires to sensors detecting electrical failures to the science of fireworks, which wish we had talked to you about that 6 weeks ago. But what a good time you have. Do you consider that you have a specialty, or do you just like anything that comes your way that's science or techie?
So I'm technology editor at Scientific American now, and
right.
My beat is anything under the umbrella of tech. But given the world we live in, that is a very large umbrella. And I think one of the really interesting things about tech in, you know, the year 2019 and beyond is just how many areas of our daily life it affects. So yeah, if you there is devices that you can plug into your home electricity system that can tell you, you know, when you know, maybe your stove is going to undergo an electrical failure, and there's medical advances that rely really heavily on technology to either maybe crunch the numbers for data or to develop these extremely high-tech prosthetic arms. It's just a big tent, and I think it's really interesting seeing how those two intersect, daily life and the new technology and how it's changing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, tune in to Sophie's article. It's Anonymous Data Won't Protect Your Identity. You can do that little test to see how easily detectable you are and your identity is by just putting in your birthday, gender, and zip code. It's very fascinating. Sophie, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.